asked to view that bus, they were presented with a different bus that had been made up to look like it. One of their
John, we have 10 seconds. How has the family responded, and will the Mexican government open a new investigation?
They will open a new investigation. The family has fully embraced the report and also denounced the government for torturing them. They said that this theory of the trash dump has been torture for us, and they are fully supporting the report.
John Gibler, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll continue to follow this story of the 43 missing students in Guatemala. That does it for the show in Mexico. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. The time is 4:59. Stay tuned for the KBOO Evening News.
Dear KBOO listeners, I have one simple question for you. What is your favorite Hank Williams song? We are dedicating our September 12th Swingin' Country program to the music of Hank Williams, and we would like your input. We are calling it All Things Hank Consider, just to annoy the good people at National Public Radio. So please email us at program@kboo.org and tell us your favorite song by Hank Williams or your favorite song about Hank Williams, and we will play it on the September 12th Swingin' Country show right here on your community radio station. Once again, that email is program@kboo.org. So tune in September 12th at 6 a.m. as we solemnly pledge to play Hank, all Hank, and nothing but Hank. So help me God.
Alone and forsaken by fate and by man. Oh, Lord, if you hear me, please hold my hand.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present Arresting Power, Resisting Police Violence in Portland, Oregon, as part of the KBOO at the Clinton Monthly Film Series. Arresting Power documents the history of conflict between the Portland police and community members throughout the past 50 years and creates a space for understanding the impacts of police violence and imagining a world without police. Again, that's Arresting Power, Thursday, September 10th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, former local police chief charges charges of unbridled racism.
Solar windows are in development, but Pacific Power does not like renewable energy.
Area 51 is due to grow as the Air Force uses eminent domain to grab a heritage mine. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 8th, 2015. I'm Connie Kazanowski.
And I'm Jared Dantzler. The parents of Freddie Gray reached a tentative $6.4 million settlement with the city of Baltimore. Gray, a 25-year-old black man, was killed while in police custody. The settlement still needs the approval of a board that oversees city spending. The mayor of Baltimore says the proposed settlement should not be interpreted as a judgment on the guilt or innocence of the officers facing trial. The settlement is being proposed solely because it is in the best interest of the city and avoids costly and protracted litigation. All six officers, including Edward Nero and Garrett Miller, are charged with second-degree assault, misconduct in office, and reckless endangerment. Lieutenant Brian Rice, Sergeant Alicia White, and Officer William Porter also face a manslaughter charge, while Officer Caesar Goodson faces the most serious charge of all, second-degree depraved heart murder. Three of the officers are black, and three are white. Their attorneys have asked the judge in this case to move their trials out of the city.
Several companies are now beginning to roll out translucent photovoltaic films or solar cells embedded in windows that can supplement a significant amount of energy in the buildings where they're used. One company is aiming at supplementing 20 to 30% of a skyscraper's power requirements. Solar Window Technologies, for example, is preparing to launch a transparent product made with organic photolicks, while another company, Solaria, is cutting solar cells into thin strips and embedding them into windows. Both companies admit that efficiency of their solar windows is less than the 20% efficiency typical of roof top freestanding panels, but their stated main objective is to make use of the millions of skyscraper windows that today are simply unused real estate for renewable energy. And Oxford University has spun off a PV window company aiming to produce window-embedded solar cells made of semi-transparent perovskite oxide that is expected to achieve a 20% solar energy efficiency.
The Sierra Club has filed a motion to intervene in Pacific Power's request before the Oregon Public Utility Commission. According to the motion, Pacific Power is attempting to stifle the expansion of clean energy in Oregon by undermining state policies that foster renewable energy growth locally. PacifiCorp, through their subsidiary, Pacific Power in Portland, has proposed dramatically shortening the length of contracts it secures to purchase clean energy like wind and solar. Current contracts run 15 years, allowing small solar and wind companies to ensure a stable source of revenue, but Pacific Power wants those contracts cut down to just 3 years. According to the Sierra Club and other environmental groups, that would have a chilling effect on Oregon's burgeoning clean energy industry. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Sierra Club staff attorney Travis Ritchie.
What is this request that Pacific Power is making in the state?
Specific request that is before the Oregon Public Utility Commission right now relates to facilities that are able to sell power to the utility under something called PURPA, which is a federal law that allows qualified renewable energy facilities to compete with the utility that otherwise gets to operate as a monopoly.
And how does PURPA, or the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act, apply here in Oregon?
Well, what PURPA says is that if you're a facility that meets certain requirements, and a lot of smaller clean energy facilities can meet these requirements, facilities that are less than 80 megawatts, basically if you're a developer and you can offer energy at a price that is at or below the public the utility's avoided costs, then you have a right to sell that power to the company and they have to accept it. And the way it works is that there's something called the ratepayer indifference standard. So the test for whether or not the utility has to buy your power is whether or not you can provide it at an economically competitive price. So by definition, this power is coming in priced below what the utility's avoided cost is.
And how is PacifiCorp's request to the Oregon Public Utility Commission actually going to impact that?
Well, what PacifiCorp has asked for here, and what they've asked for in Idaho and in Utah and in Wyoming, where they also serve customers, is they've asked to shorten the standard contract term for these projects coming in. Right now, contracts get a 15-year fixed term when they come in under PURPA, and that's good for the companies who are bidding in because it means that they have certainty in their financing. They're able to go out and get folks to fund these projects with a certainty that they'll have a revenue stream. PacifiCorp wants to cut that down to 3 years in Oregon, which would make financing for these projects virtually impossible.
Right now, Oregon gets about a third of our energy from coal. What's the role of Pacific Power in that?
Right, Oregon gets about a third, and Pacific Power is responsible for a large share of that. Pacific Power has about two-thirds of their energy that comes from coal. They have coal plants in Wyoming, in Utah, Montana, Colorado, and Arizona. And they are planning to keep a lot of those plants open, you know, for 20 years or more, essentially indefinitely. And this push on PURPA and an attempt to stop some of these renewable energy facilities from coming in, I think will keep those coal plants online for longer than they otherwise would be.
One of them, of course, being Boardman Coal Plant here in Oregon that's scheduled to go offline in the next 15 years. Would this extend the life of Boardman?
No, Boardman is a different situation. First of all, Boardman is not a Pacific Power plant. That the PacifiCorp and Pacific Power don't get their energy from Boardman. That's from Portland General Electric. And that should not be affected by this PURPA proceeding.
If PacifiCorp is successful in reducing the contract time for these alternative energy companies, what was the response from the Public Utility Commission to the request by Pacific Power?
The proceeding is still ongoing. So right now, folks are still getting involved. There have been various parties who have intervened in the proceeding to take part, Sierra Club, along with other clean energy advocates. And so the commission, the Public Utilities Commission, has not taken a position at this time. They'll wait for folks to present their case, and then they'll make a decision in the future.
And can you talk about the advantage of solar and wind energy over coal?
Yes. One of the big advantages of renewable energy like solar and wind is that there's a lot more price certainty. The cost for solar and wind development come up front. They're the capital costs for building the project. But once it's built, it has a very reliable renewable energy stream at reliable costs. Whereas if you look at coal or if you look at natural gas, those prices can fluctuate quite a bit depending on the cost of the fuel that's going into the plant or the costs for pollution controls that utilities have to put on the plants to meet stricter and stricter requirements to protect public health and the environment.
Is there any legislation at the state level or any possibility of legislating to ensure that the clean power companies continue to get the support that they need here in the state?
I'm not aware of any specific legislation on this issue.
Well, and we will here at KBOO continue to follow this as Pacific Power challenges the expansion of clean energy in Oregon by undermining state policies that foster such renewable energy. Again, I've been speaking with Travis Ritchie. He is a staff attorney with the Sierra Club, and more information can be found on their website, sierraclub.org. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
A Class 9 police officer who filed a complaint against a superior officer has claimed that retaliatory action has been taken against him. This summer, a complaint was filed in Class 9, Oregon, against then-acting police chief Marvin Hoover. The complaint cites racism comments he made while on duty. Marvin Hoover had been retired for some years and worked for the city on an annual improved contract. The complaint was filed by Officer Dustin Stone, who says he's never worked under a manager and who was openly racist before. In his report, he quotes former Chief Hoover referring to a black arrestee as an animal, imitating ape behavior and pounding his chest like Tarzan. The complaint was filed directly with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and a separate investigation was launched by the city of Clascanai. Rather than wait for the investigation's completion, the city council voted to allow the police chief to retire. The local paper, the chief, reports that Amy Driscoll of Clascanai raised concerns during public comment at the September 2nd city council meeting. Driscoll said that the community was uninformed of the racist allegations regarding the police chief's retirement. Mayor Diane Pohl said that the Clascanai city attorney advised her not to make any statement regarding the city's investigation. The mayor also refused to comment on either investigation. Driscoll urged the city council to let the public know about the concerns surrounding this case of racial discrimination in the Clascanai Police Department.
And now, a look at This Week in Water, brought to you by HTO Radio.
How Native peoples are beating big oil. That and other stories for the week ending September 6, 2015.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
Most people are aware of the plans to build the controversial Keystone XL pipeline from Canada through the U.S. But in addition to Keystone, there are plans to build other oil and gas pipelines through Alberta and British Columbia.
Chevron and TransCanada are trying to build gas projects through the territories of the native group known as the Unist'ot'en.
And a third company, Enbridge, is trying to build a pipeline that would transport bitumen from Alberta tar sands to the Pacific coast.
The native peoples are fighting these pipelines because of their concerns, not only about breaks, shipping accidents along the coast of British Columbia, but also degradation of their ancestral lands and waters.
In efforts to stop these pipelines, the Unist'ot'en have established a camp to block the oil giants from surveying their lands. The camp sits right in the middle of one of the proposed pipeline routes.
They've also established checkpoints to learn the intentions of those who wish to enter native territory and have turned back industry employees and even the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
Last week, however, the native chiefs of British Columbia announced that they had been told the police were planning a major crackdown on the Unist'ot'en, and there were reports that security forces increased their presence in small towns near the remote area, about 600 miles north of Vancouver.
The Canadian government denied rumors of any law enforcement buildup.
In related news, Indigenous peoples of Ecuador have long suffered the consequences of oil drilling operations that severely contaminated their waters and lands between 1964 and 1992.
The Ecuadorians, 30,000 in all, sued Chevron and were awarded $9.5 billion by courts in Ecuador. But the oil giant hasn't paid a cent and is trying hard not to do so.
Last week, in a major victory for the Ecuadorians, the Canadian Supreme Court said in a unanimous decision that the judgment against Chevron from Ecuador's courts could be enforced in Canada.
Chevron was trying to get the court to dismiss the case, but now the villagers can continue their efforts to collect the billions of dollars they're owed by seizing the company's assets in Canada.
Most of us recognize the immediate effects of rising carbon levels in our atmosphere, but not as well known as the fact that the oceans absorb carbon dioxide.
The absorption causes the acidification of the water, which leads to the destruction of coral reefs and the marine food chain.
Last week, Jim Berry, a senior scientist at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, explained to KQED that CO2 robs the ocean of an essential compound for shellfish and coral.
But even more concerning is the fact that a number of experts think we're heading into, if not already in, another great extinction. And as noted by scientist Barry, four of the five big extinctions on Earth included ocean acidification.
You probably haven't heard of Galgeria sulfurea. But according to Peter Lammers at Arizona State University, it's one of the most interesting microorganisms on the planet.
Why? Because it loves extreme temperatures, can degrade over 50 organic molecules, and even photosynthesize like a plant.
What else can it do? Treat sewage and create energy.
That's the goal of a pilot project in Las Cruces, New Mexico, where wastewater is being diverted into rows of plastic bags primed with the microbe. The algae use sunlight and carbon dioxide to grow, breaking down nitrogen and phosphates as they go.
Which is a huge breakthrough in wastewater treatment because nitrogen and phosphorus from fertilizers are a growing environmental issue. They're responsible for massive algal blooms that deplete oxygen in the water and create dead zones like in the Gulf of Mexico where fish can't survive.
Existing treatment plants can only remove about 15% of the nitrogen and around 25% of the phosphorus in wastewater. A process that requires a lot of energy.
So that's where this project gets really exciting. Thanks to the algae's growth, it creates a rich organic sludge that can then be turned into biofuel that could run the treatment facility or even create surplus electricity.
Lammers told the Guardian newspaper that the system requires a lot of sun, so probably best suited to the desert southwest. But he sees huge potential to use it in sunny areas of Africa or South America, where, according to the UN, 90% of sewage is discharged without any treatment. And finally this week, it's Labor Day weekend, so you're out playing golf, on a long bike ride, or maybe sunbathing at the beach, and you're thirsty. So you reach for your sunscreen and
take a swig. No, really, you do. That's if you've got Yuvo in your bag, a fruit drink purporting to protect your skin from the inside out.
According to the product website, UVO is a synergistic formula of powerful vitamins, photonutrients, and antioxidants, scientifically proven to protect the skin from the sun's ultraviolet rays.
But that depends on your definition of scientifically and protect. The only science behind this product is that some oral antioxidants might provide protection from solar radiation.
But even in those studies, the amount of protection is pretty minimal, maybe by an SPF level of 1 or 2 at most. So dermatologists who reviewed the product said stick with topical sunscreen.
While the product couldn't hurt you, using a drinkable sunscreen seems hard to swallow at $5 a 12-ounce bottle.
This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at coloradowaterwise.org.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, is now involved in investigating the increased numbers of whale deaths in the Gulf of Alaska. Since last reported in July, 15 more whales, humpbacks primarily, have been spotted floating in the water or have been washed ashore. The event has now been officially declared an unusual mortality event. UME, which brings in federal government resources to help determine what is happening. Still, there are a few clues as to what the cause or causes may be. Cited is the difficulty in reaching the carcasses that are washed in onto rocky coastlines, and the fact that by the time they are found, whether on land or sea, decomposition has hampered the gathering of meaningful information. According to the NOAA, understanding and investigating marine mammal, UME, is important because they can serve as indicators of ocean health, giving insight into larger environmental issues, which also have implications for human and health and welfare. Since 1991, 61 such events have been declared, but so far only 29 cases have been solved. It is not known yet whether this event is isolated to Alaska. However, higher numbers of decreased animals are being found along the entire West Coast.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the Tuesday Evening News.
Greetings. You're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. This week, in honor of our National Labor Day holiday, which took place yesterday, I'm going to read excerpts from a seminal article about labor organizing versus corporate constitutional so-called rights. It's titled Labor Must Challenge Corporate Rule and was originally published in 1999 by Peter Kelman, an extraordinary labor organizer and author. I hope you find it as fascinating as I do. It is time for labor to go beyond signing contracts with corporations. We need to start challenging the very concept of corporate privilege and rule. The people of this country need to act on the understanding that we the people create corporations through our state legislatures. As the Pennsylvania legislature declared in 1834, quote, "A corporation in law is just what the Incorporation Act makes it. It is the creature of the law and may be molded to any shape or for any purpose the legislature may deem most conducive for the common good," unquote. If we don't mold corporations, they will continue to mold us. They will mold us at the expense of our rights, our health, our democracy, our communities, our environment, and most importantly, our souls. For almost 80 years, labor's message has been primarily limited to protecting the interests of organized workers. But workers' rights don't exist in a vacuum. A fundamental law of physics can also be applied to politics. Two things cannot occupy the same place at the same time. Workers' rights in this country have been relegated to a little space under a chair in the corner of a large room occupied by corporate rights. People have inalienable rights. Corporations have only the privileges we the people give them, because corporations are created by people through their legislatures. Corporations are not mentioned in the Constitution. Their constitutional privileges stem from Supreme Court cases, judge-made law. In Santa Clara County versus the Southern Pacific Railroad Corporation, 1886, the Supreme Court declared that equal protection of the laws applies to these corporations.
Equal protection is a term used in the 14th Amendment to bring African Americans under constitutional protection. The activist court of 1886 bestowed equal protection on the corporation. This judicial conversion of people's rights to corporate privilege has done much to create the present situation. The price of each expansion of corporate privilege has been a contraction in workers' rights. Every day, union people are confronted with this erosion of their rights in union organizing, internal governance, the political process, and authority over union property such as pension funds. Look, for example, how the court's role diminishes the power of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, to the detriment of workers' rights. OSHA was put in place by Congress in 1970. When you called up OSHA, it would send an investigator to your place of work. Corporate managers objected and went to court. They argued that the corporation should be afforded the same protection that flesh and blood people have under the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable searches of their property. They said OSHA inspectors needed a search warrant to inspect corporate property. In 1978, Marshall v. Barlow, the Supreme Court of the United States, agreed. So the right of individual people to be protected from the government arbitrarily entering a person's home was extended to corporations. The court ruled that corporations have the privilege to require OSHA inspectors to get a search warrant before entering corporate property to investigate the complaints of a worker regarding her health and welfare. In this case, while the OSHA inspector is getting a warrant from a judge, the corporation can clean up its act and avoid being found in violation of the law. The OSHA case is but one example of how the granting of privileges to corporations diminishes the rights of workers. Another is the way corporate employers injected employer free speech rights into the process by which workers exercise their right to associate in choosing a union to represent them in the workplace. Under the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, the National Labor Relations Board, NLRB, required employer neutrality when it came to the self-organization of workers. That is, if an employer interfered in any way with a union organizing drive, it was considered a violation of the act. Quote, "The right of employees to choose their representatives when and as they wish is normally no more the affair of the employer than the right of the stockholders to choose directors is the affair of employees," unquote, stated the board. However, with the 1947 passage of the Taft-Hartley Act, termed the Slave Labor Act by labor, corporate privilege was inserted into labor rights and corporations were granted free speech in the union certification process. If you are involved in a union organizing drive, the brutality of the corporate employer's use of free speech to usurp the worker's right to freedom of association becomes apparent in many ways. One example is called the captive audience meeting, where the employer assembles workers during working hours and harangues them on the negative consequences of unionization. So much for a worker's right to freely associate. So what is labor to do? Labor should take a sabbatical for a year and use the time to analyze what we have been doing over the past century. Then, with history as a guide and real democratic participation of the membership, labor could put together a new agenda that promotes workers' rights and attacks corporate privileges. I've been reading excerpts from an article titled "Labor Must Challenge Corporate Rule" by Peter Kelman, a labor organizer and author of a number of books, including Building Unions, Divided We Fall, and Pain on Their Faces. You can put Peter Kelman's name in Google and find many more of his provocative articles about labor and corporate rule. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the Cable Evening News in Portland and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my twice monthly updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at @cienfuegospaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this broadcast for KBOO In Depth, followed by A Preference at 6, hosted by Alan Silver. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be just about like today, with a high near 79. On this day in 1810, the sailing ship Tonkin leaves New York with 33 employees of Jacob Astor's New Pacific Fur Company. 6 months later, they arrived at the mouth of the Columbia River, where Astor's men established the town of Astoria and began trading for furs with the Indians. And in 1974, President Gerald Ford pardons former President Richard M. Nixon for any crimes arising from the Watergate scandal he may have committed while in office. And Gerald Ford says, "My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over."
It's 5:30, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Congratulations, Mr. and Ms. Middle Class America. You're all the rage in the present presidential contest. Jeb, Hillary, and all the rest, even the Donald, say their campaigns are all about you. Well, don't look now, but after each one promises that they'll do the most for the great mass of the middle class, shh. They disappear into the shadows and scurry off to schmooze with a little group of Americans they truly love, the super rich, who are shoveling the big bucks into nearly every presidential pretender. More than half of the huge sums of campaign cash that have been funneled so far into the secretive super PACs of the Republican candidates has come not from regular folks, but from, get this, just 130 fat cats and the corporations they run. Jeb Bush got $1 million each from 26 of his super PAC backers. Hillary Clinton took $1 million each from 9 funders. Of the $16 million in Marco Rubio's PAC, 78% came from only 4 donors. And Ted Cruz got the most from the fewest, taking practically all of his $37 million from just 3 fat cat families. So, while candidates for the highest office in our land are soaking up applause for the grand rhetoric they're giving to the middle class, they're quietly sacking up millions of dollars by pledging their steadfast fealty to the ruling class. Donating millions is not an innocent or noble political transaction. Written on the backs of their checks is their corporate agenda, trumping the people's agenda. This is Jim Hightower saying, ironically, it's Donnie Trump, the bombastic billionaire, who candidly admits that these so-called gifts amount to the outright plutocratic purchase of politicians. He's long been a campaign donor in order to secure financial favors, he confesses, and it works. When I need something from them, they are there for me. There's a word for that, corruption.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Tucked into the Tickaboo Valley in western Nevada, an old privately owned mine faces the threat of government buyout or condemnation because of its prime location overlooking Area 51. The U.S. government is offering $5.2 million to the landowners of Groom Mine, or it will be seized via eminent domain proceedings citing national security issues by Air Force officials. More than 20 family members and co-owners of the land are fighting to keep the property that grandparents and great-grandparents mined when Ulysses S. Grant was president. The Air Force bomb range extends to the edge of the Sheehan family land. A nuclear test site is 15 miles away. AP reported in July 1984, Pat Sheehan said in a mysterious explosion destroyed the family's mineral processing plant in 1954 when nearby Area 51 was in its infancy. He said nearby nuclear testing caused radiation burns on the arm of his brother Bob Sheehan. The brother sent a letter to the Air Force in 1986 valuing the land at $13.6 million. To the latest offer by the federal government, the landowners are saying no. They want to keep their heritage land, even if this is, as the Fed put it, the last best offer.
Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon finally gave his support to the diplomatic deal with Iran negotiated by the Obama administration. He joined 41 other Democrats in supporting the deal, giving President Obama more than enough votes to prevent a bill that opposes the measure. This means that the bill will not pass the Senate, even though the president had promised to veto it if it did pass. A bill opposing the nuclear deal would have shown a lack of support for the president. Former Vice President Dick Cheney was interrupted while giving a presentation opposing the deal with Iran. The protester with Code Pink asked, "Why are we even listening to Dick Cheney? He was wrong on Iraq, and he is wrong in Iran. She then accused him of being a war criminal.
Why should we be listening to him? He was wrong in Iraq.
Get out of here.
Thank you very much.
That was a Code Pink protester interrupting Dick Cheney and accusing him of being a war criminal.
A report by the Guardian newspaper has found that as students across the U.S. return to school this week, segregation is at its highest level in the past 60 years. The report found that a substantial majority of Black and Latino students attended schools segregated by race and poverty, which are linked to poor education. Millions of students around the U.S. have started the school year with familiar rituals, waiting for absent teachers, flipping through outdated books, and watching their peers fall behind. These students attend de facto segregated schools that remain in place in states across the country. Little has changed since a 2014 report concluded that 60 years after the Supreme Court declared segregation unconstitutional, major regions of the U.S. have turned away from integration towards deeper inequality. Gary Orfield, a UCLA professor and co-author of that report, told reporters that the substantial majority of Black and Latino students are in schools segregated by race and poverty. These students, he says, are facing a downward spiral in a society that increasingly demands college diplomas for entering the labor force.
Los Angeles County has settled a lawsuit for $1.6 million with the family of a mentally ill young man who killed himself while in custody. The settlement follows a legally binding agreement between the county and the Department of Justice to update jail protocols for mentally ill inmates. The issue of jailhouse suicides received national attention in July with the death of a 28-year-old Sandra Bland in Waller County, Texas, although Bland's family has questioned if her death was due to suicide. According to a recent report from the Justice Department, suicides are not only the leading cause of death in county jails across the country, they're also on the rise, and few of these jails have the resources or the staff to prevent them. From Los Angeles and our friends at Free Speech Radio News, Larry Boole has more.
And it showed the jails have a suicide rate 7 times higher than the rate in prisons. Some experts say the high rate of suicides in jail is due to the shock people experience when they're first arrested and locked up, facing the possible loss of jobs and support systems. And prisons are more likely than jails to have mental health professionals on staff to do crisis intervention.
Jails are a bit like emergency rooms from a healthcare perspective.
Eric Balaban is senior staff counsel with the ACLU National Prison Project.
There's a pretty high density of pathology in terms of lots of sick people are coming into jails. So jails have to quickly and accurately triage.
And that triage has to be done quickly, because the greatest risk of suicide in jail is within 7 days of arrest. Michelle Deitch is an attorney and criminal justice policy expert at the University of Texas Law School. Lawmakers on the Texas House County Affairs Committee questioned her on best practices in jails in the wake of Sandra Bland's death. Deitch told the committee that jails should use a nurse or mental health professional, or at least someone with specialized mental health training, to screen all new arrestees.
There needs to be an identification of what level of risk they present. Someone who is actively suicidal, they need to be very closely observed, face-to-face observation checks by a staff member, where the staff member isn't just looking at them, but is actually engaging with them in some way.
Another issue is where incarcerated mentally ill should be housed. Typically, when someone is determined to be a risk, he or she is placed in isolation. Deitch says that practice needs to stop.
Even though it's very commonly done to put a suicidal person in isolation, in fact, it's very traumatizing for them. So putting them in a multi-occupancy cell is a much better strategy in most cases.
Deitch admits that making the necessary changes to prevent suicides could strain the resources of many jails, especially smaller ones. But even when a jail has the resources to do the right thing, often they do the wrong thing and then double down on their mistakes. Phil Cho has suffered from schizophrenia and a mood disorder for years, but he never had a run-in with the law until 2005. That year, he spent almost 10 months total during two stints in L.A.'s famous Twin Towers men's jail. Once he was arrested for writing a bad check, the second time for trespassing, for sitting in a hotel lobby. He was homeless at the time.
At Twin Towers, what they do is, when I was processed through reception, I told the deputy I was schizophrenic. The first thing he does is he handcuffs me to a bench, an isolated cell by myself, and leaves me there for about, I would say, 7-8 hours, handcuffed to a bench. I couldn't move, couldn't drink water, couldn't use the bathroom, I couldn't do anything. That's how they treat people with schizophrenia. I wasn't violent, I wasn't acting rude, I wasn't acting out, I was just sitting.
Cho never attempted suicide at Twin Towers, but he recounts a nightmarish scenario of abuse at the hands of deputies and officials who had no idea how to handle his mental condition. Abuse bad enough that he needed treatment for post-traumatic stress after he was released.
The total time of about 1 year I was there in Twin Towers, I was seen by a doctor once, only once. And that one time was when I begged the deputy sheriff so I could get my medication. I was going through severe withdrawal symptoms for my illness, and they would not give me meds. There is no follow-ups. There is no how you doing on your medications, how are your symptoms. There is no treatment. At most, you will receive is medication, if you're lucky.
Justice reform advocates point out that the lack of public health care for mentally ill creates a revolving door between jails and the streets for many people like Cho, people who need adequate treatment and safe housing, not handcuffs. Again, Eric Balaban.
Jails are not hospitals, and sheriffs are not medical directors, but they have the responsibility to treat and safely house very sick men, women, and children because of this failure of community resources.
Some jurisdictions have implemented crisis intervention teams with mental health professionals to recognize mental illness and help keep people out of jails. Los Angeles is one of those cities. As for Twin Towers, reforms are on the way. Under pressure from the U.S. Justice Department in August, the L.A. County Sheriff agreed to federal oversight and promised to make sweeping changes that include professional supervision of mentally ill prisoners and extensive mental health training for deputies. That's one jail out of 3,200 jails across the U.S., and experts say few of them have taken steps to prevent suicide within their walls. Larry Buell, FSRN, Los Angeles.
And now the latest in news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imamc.org, for Tuesday, September 8, 2015. Israeli tanks invade areas in Gaza, and in the West Bank, settlers attack a Palestinian civilian, injuring him. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian teenager was attacked on Tuesday morning by a number of Israeli extremists while heading to his work in West Jerusalem and suffered various cuts and bruises. The Wadi Hilwa Information Center in Silwan in occupied East Jerusalem said that three assailants chased Mustafa Al-Hashlamon, 18 years of age, before one of them struck him with a baton and the three proceeded to assault him. The center added that he managed to escape during the attack and went to his workplace, suffering various cuts and bruises in addition to sharp pains in his right arm. The police arrived at the scene and initiated an investigation into the assault. On Monday at night, a group of Israeli extremists hurled stones on Palestinian homes in their Istia town, west of the central West Bank city of Salfit, causing property damage and obscenity attacks among children. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers accompanied by armored bulldozers invaded on Tuesday morning Palestinian farmlands in Ar-Rashida village east of the West Bank city of Bethlehem and placed a road barrier blocking an agricultural road. The road was prepared for use nearly a year ago to enable the residents to enter their olive orchards and lands close to the Ma'ale Amos illegal colony built on private-owned Palestinian lands. Earlier on Tuesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers invaded several Palestinian communities in different parts of the occupied West Bank and kidnapped 13 Palestinians after storming their homes and violently searching them. In the Gaza Strip on Tuesday, about five Israeli military tanks stormed and razed farmlands near the town of Khuzza'a in the southern Gaza Strip. Palestinian farmers fled their lands in fear of being attacked by Israeli tanks. Damage was reported, but no injuries. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, September 8, 2015, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Jmawi and me, Ghassan Bandura.